From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Talks on the future of Yemen are set to start in Geneva on June 14th. That according to an announcement by the United Nations. The move was welcomed by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who called on all participants to engage in consultations in good faith. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
The 14th of June consultations are expected to bring all warring parties to the negotiating table in an effort to stem the ongoing violence affecting the country. Over 20 million people are in need of some form of humanitarian assistance in the Gulf country, according to the UN. Welcoming the new date for consultations, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged participants to go to the talks in good faith and without preconditions. He's also called for a pause in fighting to allow in humanitarian aid. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
That was, without question, the best Alphorn performance that I've ever heard. I have to admit that I forgot to bring my lederhosen, but I'm going to see if I can buy some while I'm here.
That was President Barack Obama Sunday in Germany's Bavarian Alps as the leaders of the G7 nations, the U.S., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the U.K., gathered there under a heavy police presence for the group's 40th summit, a summit overshadowed by Greece's debt crisis, continued U.S. pressure for sanctions against Russia, and thousands of protesters.
We are showing our faces to protest against a huge waste of money for a 2 days business meeting of people who want to talk about making money, but not about changing the climate or helping the poor people.
RT's Harry Fear was at the protests.
The messages are anti-G7, they're anti-TTIP, they're anti-NATO, they're anti-global inequality, and they're anti-war.
At Sunday's opening of the G7, European Council President Donald Tusk made it clear that Russia was still on the outs.
All of us would prefer to have Russia around the G7 table, but our group is not only the political or economic group of interest, but first of all, this is a community of values. And that is why Russia is not among us here today. My intention is that today we reconfirm the G7 unity on the sanctions policy. So let me state clearly, given the current situation, if anyone wants to start a debate about changing the sanctions regime, the discussion could only be about strengthening it.
His tone was echoed by British Prime Minister David Cameron, French President François Hollande, and President Obama.
We're going to discuss our shared future. A global economy that creates jobs and opportunity, maintaining a strong and prosperous European Union, forging new trade partnerships across the Atlantic, standing up to Russian aggression in Ukraine.
According to some observers, even some European G7 members privately take issue with Tusk's view of relations with Moscow. One such observer is journalist Tony Gosling, who told RT's Kevin Owen that he saw the U.S. driving the hostilities.
Look, this is old Cold War talk. It's really driven by the Americans, and it certainly doesn't represent the views of European people or business, which is a bit worrying, isn't it? That you've got all these so-called leaders on a completely different page to most of the 250 million of the public of Europe. So that's one of the things that bothers me most about this, is they do seem to be on another planet.
Whatever the outcome with respect to relations between the group and Moscow, many Russians aren't worrying about the doings in Bavaria. One such person is Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international relations and security at Moscow State University, who spoke with us via Skype from Moscow Wednesday. So, tough tone by Cameron, Hollande, and Obama at the G7 instead of the G8, of course. And some crack, I think, in the walls. These people off the record appear to be saying that Europe is being hurt as well by the sanctions.
Well, there's no question of that. In fact, many people have said that Europe is being hurt by the sanctions more than Russia is. I mean, certain sectors of you know, certain facets of the Russian economy have been hurting, and that's for sure. I know I have to buy domestically made Parmesan instead of imported Parmesan when I make fettuccine Alfredo. But that's about the only thing that affects me.
Like Russian cheese anyway. Russian dairy products are fantastic.
They're good. They tend to. They're very fresh. They're very good. They tend to be a little bit plain for Western tastes, right? But you know what? It works. It's fine. I can give up imported aged Italian Parmesan cheese to save the lives of people in Donbass.
Well, garlic and fresh tomato, but because you have great fresh produce there too.
Incredible produce. Anyway, import substitute. Russia's agricultural food production sector is booming. The manufacturing sector, having to do things on their own instead of having their market flooded with cheaper Western goods right now is increasing Russia's self-sufficiency and their economy. I like the sanctions. It's crazy. And you'll hear a lot of other Russian political figures say this. The sanctions are good for us, and business figures as well. The sanctions are good for us. We don't want to see them lifted anytime soon. It's actually hurting European agriculture.
Yeah, right. That's right. And that's where I think some of the rumblings are coming from. Not only
German manufacturing.
Yeah. So now, I can't buy stuff, manufactured goods from Germany. I'm going to have to buy them from China. So trade with China increases, so now they're building a rail link and all this other stuff, and the biggest business deal in the world last year after the sanctions were announced.
Hey, all my pad, my phone, my computer, all Lenovo. I love Chinese.
Yeah,
so.
Right. What do you think it means, since it appears that they're going to be following that line soon? What do you think it means for the EU itself? Forget the G7, but the EU, you've got the Greece situation going on. Spain will be there, in 10 minutes, and some others. And Varoufakis today was speaking of, essentially, he didn't couch it in those terms, but both a class antagonism across the continent and also an antagonism of the North against the South and trying to bridge that. But can they do it? And if you're going to be eaten out from the middle by sanctioning Russia and having your own industries suffer in the middle of this crisis, what's going to happen?
Yeah, no, I don't think they can do it. I think the EU is caught between a triple whammy of its own internal economic contradictions with the rest of the continent, particularly the South, being held as captive consumers of German manufacturing, and rising resurgence of national identities fighting against this EU technocratic neoliberal centric bureaucracy that seeks to disenfranchise national politics at every level now, and then this we can call it imperial overstretch into the Ukraine that EU taxpayers and the IMF are now having to shove regularly. I mean, we're up to tens of billions of dollars. They keep shoving money into that black hole to prop up that regime and keep it killing in Donbass. And, they don't really have anything to show for it. Right. This G7 summit, let's be honest, it's such a complete waste of time. It was a complete waste of time with the G8. And you found it very hard to find a serious foreign policy, international relations commentator who would not say that the G8 format was a useless talking shop. All right, nothing constructive comes out of it, and that at least the G20 is what needs to be considered, if not bigger formats, and that with the world's global economy now, with the rise of China and such other economic powers as Indonesia, South Korea, the G7, even the G8 is outdated, and without Russia there, it's positively useless. It's a Western backslapping and mutual appreciation society. Nothing was done at the G7 summit. Okay, they spoke about unanimity that they have for almost nothing. We know that Europe is divided on the matter, even of sanctions. Right. We know that there's no unanimity on resolving the the impending Greek crisis with the Greek default. There's no unanimity on anything, but you know, they say all the right words. They take a glum picture with Angela Merkel in pink stuck in the middle of a bunch of gray suits. That's your talking shop and photo op right there. But as an institution, the G7 is worthless.
But despite Sunday's Cold War rhetoric from Washington, London, and Paris, Greece was at the center stage Monday, despite the fact that it wasn't on the G7's formal agenda, as the country's foreign minister, Yanis Varoufakis, delivered a speech on the crisis in the Eurozone. Before he spoke, Varoufakis and German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble held an impromptu meeting related to the intense negotiations over Greece's debt. Since Varoufakis' Syriza party won the national elections held earlier this year, Greek authorities and the group of lending institutions have been locked in 5 months of negotiations over $8 billion of rescue funds to pay the IMF on the debt. The latest extension ends on June 30th, and if Greece fails to meet the deadline, that could pave the way for default and exit from the Eurozone. Varoufakis spoke for about 45 minutes, detailing the history of post-war Europe, the EU, and his own country, as well as the history and nature of the crisis that faces Greece and the EU. We bring you that speech in its entirety this week. This is part one of two parts.
Dear Gesine, dear Gustav, thank you for this excellent opportunity. Thank you for the invitation. To all of you, thank you for being here. Thank you for the warm welcome. Above all, thank you for this opportunity to build bridges, to pave common ground, to bring harmony in the face of several attempts to sow the seeds of discord between peoples whose historic duty is to come closer together. Since the end of the war, the Greeks and the Germans, together with the rest of the Europeans, have been uniting. We have been uniting despite different languages, diverse cultures, distinctive temperaments. In the process of coming together, we were discovering with great joy that there are fewer differences between our nations than the difference observed within our nations. Then came the global financial disaster of 2008. And a year or two later, European peoples, who were, as I said, hitherto uniting so splendidly, ended up increasingly divided by a common currency. A paradox that would have been delightful if it were not so fraught with danger. Danger for our peoples. Danger for our future. Danger for the idea of a shared European prosperity. History does seem to have a flair for farce, judging by the way it sometimes repeats itself. The Cold War did not begin here in Berlin. It began in the streets of Athens in December 1944. The Euro crisis also started life in Athens in 2010, triggered off by Greece's debt problems. Greece was, by a twist of fate, the birthplace of both the Cold War and the Euro crisis. But the causes, of course, for both, run much wider than the streets of Athens, and they spanned the whole of our continent. Now, what were the causes of the Euro crisis? Now, news media and politicians, I may add, love simple stories. Like Hollywood, they adore morality tales featuring villains and victims. Aesop's fable of the ant and the grasshopper proved an instant hit. From 2010 onwards, the story goes something like this. The Greek grasshoppers did not do their homework, and their debt-fueled summer day ended abruptly. Then, The ants were called upon to bail them out. And now the German people are being told the Greek grasshoppers do not want to pay back the debt. They want another bout of loose living, more fun in the sun, and another bailout so that they can finance it. It is a powerful story, I understand that. A story underpinning a tough stance that many advocate against the Greeks, against our government. The problem is that it is a misleading story, ladies and gentlemen. A story that casts a long shadow on the truth. An allegory that is turning one proud nation against another, with losers everywhere, except perhaps the enemies of Europe and of democracy, who are having a field day. Now let me begin with a truism. One person's debt is another person's asset. Similarly, one nation's deficit is another nation's surplus. When one nation or region is more industrialized than another, when it produces most of the high value added tradable goods, while the other nation concentrates on low yield, low value added non-tradables, we have an asymmetry, a self-perpetuating asymmetry. Think not just Greece in relation to Germany. Think also East Germany in relation to West Germany. Missouri in relation to neighboring Texas. North England in relation to the greater London economy. All cases of trade imbalances with impressive staying power. Now, if you have a freely moving exchange rate between the surplus and the deficit regions or nations, like, for instance, Japan and Brazil have. Well, this freely moving exchange rate helps keep the imbalances in check at the expense of volatility. But when we fix the exchange rate to give more certainty to traders, to business, or even more powerfully, when we adopt a common currency, something else happens. Banks begin to magnify the surpluses and the deficits. They inflate those imbalances and make them more dangerous, automatically, without asking voters, or the Bundestag, or the Greek Parliament, without even the government of the land taking notice. It is what I refer to as toxic debt and surplus recycling by the banking system. It is very easy to see how this happens. During the years, the good years, in inverted commas, of the 2000s, when the Eurozone was first created, a German trade surplus over Greece generated, by definition, a transfer of euros from Greece to Germany. This is precisely what was happening during those good times, before the crisis. Euros earned by German companies in Greece, and elsewhere in the periphery, of course, amassed in the banks here, in Frankfurt, to be more precise. This money increased Germany's money supply, lowering the price of money in Germany. And what is the price of money? It's the interest rate. This is why interest rates in Germany were so low relative to other Eurozone member states. Now, suddenly, the banks of the surplus countries, the northern banks, the banks of Frankfurt, for instance, or Paris, for that matter, had a reason to lend their reserves back to the Greeks, to the Irish, to the Spanish, to nations where the interest rate was considerably higher, as capital is always scarcer in monetary unions' deficit regions. So it was that a tsunami of debt flowed from Frankfurt, from the Netherlands, from Paris, to Athens, to Dublin, to Madrid. Unconcerned by the prospect of a drachma or a lira devaluation or a peseta devaluation, as we all share the euro, and lured by the fantasy of riskless risk, that fantasy that was born in Wall Street and the City of London, but very quickly made its way onto the European continent. Now, put differently, debt flows to places like Greece, where the other side of the coin of Germany's trade surpluses. Greece's and Ireland's debt to German private banks maintained German exports to Greece and to Ireland. This is similar to buying a car from a dealer who also provides you with the loan so that you can afford to buy the car. Vendor finance is the term we use. Now, can you begin to see the problem? To maintain one nation's surpluses within a monetary union, the banking system must pile up increasing debts upon the deficit nations. It can't happen otherwise. But, ladies and gentlemen, for every irresponsible borrower, and by golly, Greece was an irresponsible borrower, there corresponds an irresponsible lender. This is why there is no profit to be had today from thinking about debt in moralistic terms. We, together, we Europeans, built an asymmetrical monetary union with rules that guaranteed the generation of unsustainable debt. This is how we constructed it. We're all responsible for it, jointly, collectively, as Europeans. And we're all collectively responsible for fixing it, as Europeans, without pointing fingers at one another, without recriminations. Now, before 2009, I remember that with horror. The Greek media were ever so proud that we Greeks, the Greek economy was growing faster than Germany. We were proud of that. Idiots that we were. Of course, we were wrong. It was pyramidic, Ponzi growth, fueled by unsustainable debt. So when our bubbles burst in 2009, 2010, the German press accused the periphery of profligacy and of being bad European citizens who got what they deserved. It was the turn of the German press to get it wrong. The periphery's exorbitant debts were essential for the flow of surpluses from the periphery to the core of our monetary union. In summary, our Eurozone surplus recycling was at the heart of the problem. In 2009-2010, when the international financial crisis hit and caused a credit crunch which led to the bursting of the bubbles in the periphery, countries like Greece and Ireland took a big hit on behalf of a Eurozone that was not designed well. We, in Greece in particular, speaking as a Greek, we took a hit so that the banks would be saved. The banks that did all the recycling so badly beforehand. To save a Eurozone economically incapable of absorbing the shockwaves of the great financial crisis of 2008, that the Eurozone design had created, and which Europe was politically unwilling to come to terms with and to try to redesign it in good time. Now, for 5 years now, Europe and three different Greek governments have been misleading the people of Greece and the people of Germany. We have been pretending, speaking now as governments, that we solve the crisis by extending it into the future, pretending that the Greek nation's bankruptcy could have been dealt with by ever-increasing loans on condition of further income-sapping austerity, which undercut the nation's capacity to repay. Meanwhile, in my country, a Great Depression took hold. The political center imploded, children faint at school from malnutrition, and Nazis, yes, Nazis, are coming out of the woodwork in the streets of our cities. As I already said, it is truly pointless to indulge in the blame game. Whose fault was the crisis? We are all at fault. We created the Eurozone with a surplus recycling mechanism with which mathematical precision led to a crisis with victims everywhere. The longer we take to realize this, and the more we point fingers at one another, the more we allow proud nations to turn against one another, the greater our collective fault. Earlier, I referred to the Aesop fable, the ant and the grasshopper. that has done, in my opinion, so much damage to our people's understanding of their relation with one another and to their appreciation of each other. Allow me to retell the Aesop tale slightly differently, just for a minute. Now, to begin with, I hope you agree with the idea. Not with the idea. I hope you agree that the idea that all the ants live in the north and all the grasshoppers have congregated in the south is comical. There are ants and there are grasshoppers everywhere. There are deserving and there are undeserving people in Greece, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Malta, in Britain, everywhere. Now, what happened in Europe after we established the euro? During the good times, whether the ants worked hard everywhere, in Germany and in Greece, and the ants were finding it very hard, even during the good times, in Germany and in Greece, to make ends meet. In contrast, the grasshoppers, both in Greece and in Germany, were having a finance-fueled party. The flow of private money from the surplus to the deficit countries allowed the grasshoppers of the north and the grasshoppers of the south to create huge paper wealth for themselves at the expense of the ants of the north and the ants of the south. And then when the crisis hit, it was the ants of the north and the ants of the south that were called upon to bail out the grasshoppers, both of the north and of the south. These bailouts cost the ants very dearly in this country, as well as in my country, in Slovakia, in Italy, in Portugal, everywhere. Especially the Greek ants, which inherited a Great Depression that makes Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath come vividly alive again. They lost their jobs, their houses, their pensions, while at the very same time, the German ants felt cheated. Hearing all about all these billions that your government was sending to the Greeks, while the German ants saw their living standards refuse to rise despite their hard work, their productive efforts, the profitability of the firms in which they worked here in Stuttgart, in Aachen, everywhere. As for the Greek grasshoppers, some of them also suffered, but I can assure you that most of them, the big fat ones in Greece, had nothing to worry about. They took their ill-gotten monies to Geneva, to London, to Frankfurt, and they laughed all the way to the bank. This is what was so wrong with the bailouts. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a mistake to say that Germany did not pay enough money to Greece. Germany paid far too much, but for the wrong reasons. Money that did not help the Greeks. It was never a bailout for Greece. 91% of the money that Europe and the IMF lent to Greece went to the banks. Greek banks, German banks, French banks. It was money that was taken from the taxpayers of every country, including Greece, and thrown into a black hole of unsustainable debts, while people suffered everywhere throughout Europe. We went from the 2000s, when we had debt-fueled growth, full circle, to debt-fueled austerity. It is this vicious cycle that our government was elected a few months ago to put an end to.
And we'll have more of that speech by Greece's finance minister outside the G7 later this week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.